Off the Ball, GAA.
I mean, there was a lot of made of Congress at the weekend, and yes, a lot of different things came out of Congress. But for me, to be honest with you, I won't say it's off the ball. I think it's off the wall in terms of something like that coming into hurling.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Now Di Stefano. There's always tenor when he moves. And it's 7-2. Oh, I love this.
From the barrios of Buenos Aires to the roaring nights of Madrid, this episode traces the extraordinary journey of Alfredo Di Stefano, the visionary who redefined modern football. Born in Argentina, forged in the breakaway leagues of Colombia with Millonarios, and immortalized in Spain, he became the heartbeat of a dynasty. But what if the man they called La Saeta Rubia had taken a different path and gone to Real Madrid's biggest rivals, Barcelona? Find out on episode 6 of Richie McCormack's Sliding Doors podcast as to how European football could have been changed as we know it. Coming to you this Monday in your OTB football podcast feed for free.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.
With Optimum Nutrition, the official performance nutrition partner of the IRFU.
This is News Talk.
8th of March, 26. You're welcome along to the Sunday Paper Review, and I'm delighted to say joined in the studio by the Ireland rugby legend. I've just shortened to that. Turned coach, turned pundit, Fiona Hayes. How are you?
I'm good, really
used
good.
Used to give you a very big long intro there about all your achievements, but it just used to take up too much
legend,
of the slot, Fiona.
Legend is too kind as well. I'll take that.
Not at all. And speaking of legends, Sunday Independent writer and author Declan Lynch is with us. Declan, how are you?
Adrian, how are you?
I'm absolutely flying it, and I have been really enthused by our collective conversation in the office and the lead into this, and the quality of pieces in the paper today, so I'm always
going to be a big one. It's going to be,
but
I
have a feeling this is going to be the year for you and me. which might be relevant a little bit later on. We'll let you know what's happening across the back pages to begin with. We're going to start with the Mail on Sunday. Super Saturday, says the Mail. Ireland right in the mix for a title after shock wins for Italy and Scots. And Italy celebrate their historic win over England in Rome yesterday, is the picture on the back there. Meanwhile, ankle surgery rules Evan Ferguson out of playoffs, says he for English down here. Evan Ferguson has been officially ruled out of the game against Czechia in Prague later this month after it was announced that he is to undergo surgery to correct those troublesome ankle injuries. 21 years of age and loan at Roma, due to return to Brighton tomorrow for surgery, and he won't be going back to Serie A. This is bad news for the player. Bad news for Ireland, and very concerning. I mean, more so for the player. This has just gone on and on and on. Not something he's been able to tackle. Hopefully the surgery can sort it out, but, you know, there was even chat. I know Dan McDonald is talking about it in the Irish Independent, Sunday Independent as well, that, like, if we were to qualify even for the World Cup, and who knows about that, but that might even come too soon for him. It's all grim for him today.
Yeah, you gotta feel for him because he's such a quality player, and any time he's got a bit of game time behind him, just something happens. I mean, what was it? Was it late January when it originally happened? They thought they'd come back, and then you're in the mix, and you've Troy Parrott coming in and just being unbelievable with the goal scorers. You've got a feel for him because he's gone from a hero, I suppose, to that, and not even going back to Serie A. It's going to be a big struggle for him to get a club.
It isn't just these young players and injuries. I just know, like, if you look at Liverpool, by Chetik, Stefan, who's about a couple of years ago, yep, was the next big thing. He's just disappeared. Like, I mean, he just seems to be constantly injured. Even, you know, Jaden Danz.
Yeah,
he looked really good, right? And, you know, he's just not there. You know, like, it seems to be, you know, I don't know how wide of a problem it is, but I mean, clearly Evan Ferguson has now come into that category as well, of like just this almost never seems to be whatever, you know, maybe they play too much when they're younger or something like that. It's very hard to know. I mean, I know at Liverpool, someone like Bajetic played a lot. I mean, at one point, the people say, oh, he's the main man now, you know. So that was when he was, I guess, what, 18 or something. So maybe it's just too much. I don't know anything about the science of it, but
the optics of it are suggest that.
Yeah.
And his frame as well, he's physically a very big
player. He's a bigger player, yeah.
Has been for a while. I don't know if that's anything to do with it. Who knows? Sunday Independent Orange crush. Ireland suffers second narrow defeat after a scrappy win over the Dutch. Picture there in the back, Emily Murphy up against Viviana Miedema. Ireland losing out a couple of scrappy goals, 2-1. Very frustrating. Like, we're at the top of the tree now and we're competing at that level. It's two sides to which you can be unbelievably frustrated that we've come so close, obviously. But then there is a positive side to that, that we're competing with these bigger nations and competing very well with them.
Yeah, there is, but like, you have to look on that broader picture, that France game in particular. I mean, like, it just trying to hold defence, and in that second half, I suppose the decision making up at that level, you make one error or do something different, you're always going to be punished. And we saw the same against the Netherlands. So there's huge frustration, because watching them, they're so good, they've lifted it up a level, but then there's sloppy goals being scored, and just even from a coach's perspective, Adrian, you're delighted that you're up there, but you're also like trying to get that point across. We deserve to be here. And looking at that game, I could see the frustration right at the end.
Well, you could see even some of them in the huddle after the game last night. There wasn't a doom and it looked as if it wasn't a doom and gloom scenario, that there was a few smiles breaking out. Somebody said something to Carla Ward, there was a bit of a smile. Like, there must be that recognition that we're up at that level now and we're well able to compete with them. Would be nice to come out on the winning side.
Yes.
Yeah, it's right, like maybe our old friends, the sports psychologists, need to get in here, because someone like they've moved up a level now, but maybe like psychologically they still kind of deep down expect to get beaten. It is a very interesting thing that, I mean, I was watching Wrexham and Chelsea last night in the cup. And like, Wrexham were really good. Like, I mean, they weren't just hanging on. I mean, but they found a way to not win it, right? And one particular player. Now, it's not, I mean, that just happened to be the way this particular player let Chelsea in for the equaliser, and then got sent off, out of nothing, really. Do you know what I mean? There was no kind of, but there's a psychological aspect to those things as well.
Finding a way to lose.
Yeah. And I think I saw towards the end of the Ireland-Holland match last night as well, and you always had that feeling that, and maybe the team themselves have somewhere deep down the thing, look, we deserve to get beaten by these people still, so it takes a while, I think, to actually move into that other level of like expecting, even though technically they're obviously really, they're able to compete, sure.
Carla Ward has them looking like they're looking good, but I think it's exactly like you're saying, but one game can break that cycle as well. If they can get that win, it'll be huge for them. But certainly on the back of those two losses, there'd be frustration around the defence.
The Tottenhamification of a team, I think, is what we can call it officially. The Sunday Times goes with all eyes on Dublin again. A Scotland pull off stunning win over France to give Ireland a shot at the title on the final day, and reflections on that mad game at Murrayfield. The Scotland 50, France 40. You won't see too many scorelines like that, but 90 points scored between the teams, and I know that a lot of those France scores came when the game was up, but still loads of analysis inside as well. Peter O'Reilly, Shane Horgan, David Walsh, and then a picture of Harry Redknapp with a cup of tea in his paw. Former Spurs manager tells David Walsh about life, football and Cheltenham, and we are going to tell you all about that in a few minutes time, because that is up there with pieces of the day, must be said. The Irish Sun, Real join Tonali race, they'll fight Gunners and City for £100 million. Sandro, finishing Dutch meanwhile, Ward pleased despite defeat. The Sunday People goes with Ryan Mighty, delight for Slot and Kopp as key midfielder Gravenberch signs a new deal worth £86 million. The obligatory, I've got a pen in my hand and a piece of paper in front of me and I look like I'm signing something here, photograph. Max made it look easy. Mansfield 1, Arsenal 2 in the Cup. And then that Ryan Gravenberch story also on the Sunday Mirror. Ryan cops a mega deal. Pool talent signs on until 2032. And he admits, easy call for me. And then all about character from Martin, the Scottish Cup quarterfinal, Rangers against Celtic today at 1 o'clock. And Mark McCadden writing about Ferguson's injury as well. KO shocker, he calls it there. So we're going to go to the rugby and the rugby coverage to begin with. Fiona, up there with the greatest weekends of Six Nations rugby, obviously, in some time. We're going into the final weekend with three teams in with a chance of winning it. We're celebrating Wales today. We're celebrating Scotland. We're celebrating Italy, all for slightly different reasons. But it's been some time since the three of those really had the limelight, I suppose, as a group. We're talking about England in with an outside shot of taking the wooden spoon, possibly losing their coach in a week's time, depending on what happens in Paris, I suppose. Scotland maybe winning the thing for the first time in nearly 30 years. Ireland obviously have a shout, albeit maybe slightly outside. And France, it turns out, are fallible. What a mad tournament and what a mad weekend.
Yeah, spot on. And what about that prop as well? Scoring for Wales, Kerry. Wow. It's had a mixture of all sorts of things this weekend, but certainly I think the highlight for everyone is that Scotland-France game. And, you know, even chatting before it, Adrian, to people, everyone like, oh, Scotland, yes, they can show up, but they won't have enough for this French team. They're unbelievable. Ramos, Dupont, everyone. And just watching how they played, and Tupulatu, the two wingers, Darcy Graham, it was unbelievable. I think there was a stat at halftime. You think about that big French pack, and there was a stat at halftime that there was only something like 23 post-contact meters made by France. I mean, that is unbelievable. So it just shows you how hard Scotland defended, and also that 11, there was about 11 minutes where we never thought we'd see Dupont do things that we saw, throwing a forward pass in the end zone, and also that intercept try, you gotta feel. But it shows this competition, a lot of people thought, I suppose, that opening weekend it wasn't great, and all the other teams bar France probably weren't playing their best rugby. So I think the organisers are a big winner on this weekend, and it leads up to a good Super Saturday as well.
Yeah, and we all are as well, you know, because we were talking to Tom English on Off the Ball Breakfast during the week, and we were saying, like, we need a Scotland win here for the tournament.
Yeah.
I can't be over after four rounds, and just in what style as well. You didn't see too many pundits calling the Scotland game, although I do see Bernard Jackman pointing out in the Sunday Independent today that he was at an event that Ronan O'Gara was at during the week, and he said Scotland will hammer them. Particularly given where he's coming from. Right, ahead of next weekend, to get into the weeds of this, 50 points obviously yesterday, 7 tries, really strong scrum. Can we cope with the version of Scotland if it comes to Dublin next, with that version of Scotland, if it comes to Dublin next weekend?
No, if that comes to Dublin next weekend, I think where we're at right now, I'm not sure anyone could stop them if they play like that. But you have to remember there was that Murrayfield effect as well. Scotland just playing there are unbelievable. The crowd, everything about it, it's a cauldron to go to. I've been there a couple of times and it's unbelievable. But certainly, on the back of watching their scrum, I was a little bit worried.
Were you?
I was, because it's so tight, and their front row players carry to do all that, but their jobs they do at prop time, at front row scrum time, is just so, so good to watch. Mm. And certainly there's areas of the game I'd be a little bit worried. But then you go back and you look at that Italy game, and you look at the Scotland that showed up for that. And I suppose looking at Finn Russell, if he's not firing, the team sometimes don't fire as well.
Well, unfortunately at the minute, it just seems to be a rare weekend where he's not. What is it technically about the scrum that's impressive?
They're just so, there's very simple things you'd look at from the outside. They're so cohesive. So when you're looking at them, they're set up, everything is, you know, the connections, everything is on point. When they hit, everybody's hitting. And like, there's an old saying in rugby, all eight have to take part in the scrum. Like everyone says it, it's like a cliche. But with Scotland, you can see the flankers are scrummaging, the eight, they're just really, really good.
They blitzed them a couple of times in the first half.
Like, would you ever think you'd see a French scrum blitzed like that? And it was the sheer, and it's not, if you look at pack weights, it's not like Scotland have a lot of kgs on them. If you look at the weekend, I think it was something like 74 kgs. Wales had more than Ireland. I was shocked when I saw the stat. But looking at that French pack, I mean, they were blitzed at scrum time. It was mad to see. And certainly I think it's that cohesion. Once the belief comes in then, and you get the referee in your side, you can do a few little bits extra in there as well to give you a bit more dominance.
Gardner, did you see that in the first half, coming towards the end of the first half, Gardner said at one of the scrums something about the use of the head, and that it was a safety issue, and he was warning both. I hadn't heard that, I have to say, in the last while.
Yeah,
what was that about?
It's been a while, so it's obviously obviously as you're going in and you're trying to get your angle before, even before the hit happens, you can see the start button heads. But certainly he was watching it, because it happened in a previous scrum, and he obviously said, lads, you've got to cut that out. So if you watch it closely, there'll be a few little nudges, but they were
just to
really
give them a bit of a pre,
yeah, so
kinda.
So if I'm a loose head, I'm trying to get in between obviously the tight head and the hooker, yeah. But if you can create a little bit more space before the actual hit, it just gives you a bigger hit.
Okay. And Scotland are obviously bringing off Darcy Ray, 39th minute I think it was, and Xander Ferguson comes on. Like, real flex, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
it's, you know,
having a lines just come on, yeah. and especially when the scrum is going well as well. But that's the thing about Scotland I've noticed in this championship. It's the, you know, when you're looking at the depth at scrum time, and you're saying, okay, a lot of teams sometimes the impact goes down. France had it for years, obviously South Africa have it, but with Scotland, the front rowers that come on are just as cohesive and just as good.
Yeah, incredible game in a lot of different ways. Focus on ourselves for a minute. Bernard Jackman, we've had a couple of days to digest obviously events on Friday night, but Bernard Jackman in his piece today was saying that our win at Twickenham was a false economy, as in an untrue picture of where we're at.
Yeah, I think on the back, and that's what I was saying all week, that Ireland have to go out and put in the same performance this week against Wales, to put a lot of stuff to bed, put a chat about is scrum time, put a chat about our forwards, our footwork and contact, little things like that. But I think certainly on the back of that Wales match, you have to first of all take your hat off to Wales. They were absolutely outstanding. But or how we read the game, how we attacked, we overplayed at times. Yes, we got tries and we won, but looking at them and tweaking them, it was so much different when they're on the front foot as to when Wales' defence absolutely blitzed them and just huge hits went in. So I think that we're at a place, but I think we were sobered up a bit by that by that performance, yeah, against Wales. And look, it was a good performance, but when you look at that France and Scotland game and how they attacked, I don't know if we have the quality to attack like that.
It's very difficult to draw any conclusion about anything about this.
Yes, well, that's true also.
We have used 33 players in the Six Nations so far. What changes do you think are we making for next weekend?
I would imagine he'd probably stick with similar. I think Timney done a job, but I think he'll bring someone a bit more dynamic in. I think we might see Josh van der Fleer coming back in. I would imagine with him, it's something he's doing where it's to push him on performance-wise. So if he doesn't start the next game and we saw it, he comes out and he absolutely goes hell for leather. So there's a few psychological things going on in there as well. I think you'd have to keep the same back line, to be honest. There isn't very many
Tommy
changes.
O'Brien come in for Stockdale?
I feel like the wing is probably where, yeah, Tommy O'Brien had that game against France. He wasn't great, but on the back of what he came on in Twickenham, and you're saying, why isn't he starting the next weekend? But look, that's another thing. He'll probably get that start and he'll have a chance to go hell for leather there, because didn't start that game, and I think was it maybe 15-16 minutes into the game against England, he came on and he was absolutely superb. But it's just another thing. If you look at the aerial battle, it's just mad, isn't it? Because it was so good against England, and it's similar type of players. And then a week later, you know, just if a kick is off, if there was a couple of knock-ons in the backfield, Osborne had, you know, he was so solid, I suppose, against England. So it's mad. You can play a style of play and that kicking game. And we didn't kick as much as we obviously did, but Wales kicked to us. It just really can show that it's just week in, week out, you know, that things can go wrong one week and not the next.
Yeah. From a coach's point of view, like, that's a difficult one, because we want to do this because we can see the value of what we do against England, but then equally, like, you know, it's a 50-50 ball, and if our player is on it. Just in terms of any others, like Bundy Aki is obviously back in the mix. It was interesting to see him around and about the place. Stuart McCluskey obviously isn't going anywhere, but are they making room for him in the 23 even?
I feel like if on the basis of what if they're doing a similar type of bench than that they did last week, we saw Tom Farrell like at centre was there, and we'd obviously Frawley gives you the options of a few different places in that back line, and obviously a nine, you'll always carry a nine. So on the basis of that, I was thinking that next week we might see Bundy on the bench just to add that bit of power. Look, like, he is fit, but match fit this season, probably good, will get you a good 20 minutes, really physical 20 minutes. So to have him and his explosiveness to come off the bench, I think it would be an option, and I think that's what Andy will go for.
Big Joe, he was itching to come off. Andy Farrell was talking about him afterwards. He had the tracksuit off minutes before he ever came on. And he was like the roadrunner on the side of the pitch, you know, with the legs were going, and he was ready to get in and get involved in the action.
Yeah, see, this is the thing, right? If you look, it's all dependent on Byrne. I thought Ty Byrne was absolutely outstanding again. So, and Conan gets mad in the match. So, like, neither. So you're going to have to have a seven in there, and Ty Byrne has to go somewhere if it's second row.
Yeah,
and you're doing that way. Yeah. So that's why I'm not sure about Joe McCarthy. He obviously was unbelievable, and he adds something. But James Ryan is a different type of player. He's involved in a lot of breakdowns, a lot of rucking, does a lot of the dirty work. Mm. So I feel like maybe he could start Big Joe, but having him off the bench 45 minutes into the game is another option as well.
Not a bad option. Last one on the player changes front. Nathan Doak, obviously that has been a big talking point, hasn't it? Like, people sort of saying there's a massive gap between our starting nine and the replacement. Is it Nathan Doak's to run with, do you feel, at this stage, or does Craig Casey come back into the mix?
I think Craig Casey will come back into the mix. Just how Andy Farrell coaches and how he works, I feel like he's got a lot of guys' caps. We see Stockdale, if Stockdale doesn't start and Tommy O'Brien, like, he won't be on the bench. So I think he gives guys a chance to go out there, and I suppose a lot of the talk is around that. But also, if both nines got injured, so if Craig Casey has a lot of caps behind him, but if he gets injured and Gibson Park, say, in a season, the drop off to the amount of, you know, caps is huge. So I think he'll stick with Casey, but certainly in the summer he's going to have to get a lot more minutes into be it whoever it is. At this stage we don't know, there's so many good nines in the provinces as well. I mean, Ben Murphy, Nathan Doak, it's there. But I was reading an article in one of the papers as well about that we obviously we think our 10 should be the kicker, but having Doak there, I mean, he's unbelievable kicking.
Can
for
I
Ulster.
Ask you about that? That's David Walsh.
David Walsh, yeah.
Page of the Sunday Times. Can I ask you about that? Because we were discussing a little bit during the week. Like, so Crowley, obviously, this is one of the big talking points of Che McGrath in the Mail on Sunday. Crowley loses ground again, battle for number 10. He talks about his performance in open play was passable, hardly authoritative. His place kicking was simply poor, as he missed two conversions that have to be landed at this level. The Munster out half should keep his place for the Scottish game, but the debate about who wears the jersey from then on looks as unsettled as ever, which in a lot of ways is a very depressing thought. But that bit that you're talking about, so Crowley is still on the pitch. You mentioned earlier on about Frawley's versatility, so the likelihood is Frawley comes in, you know, that there's some, it could be very likely that Frawley comes in and Crowley is still on the pitch, I suppose, is the thing, right? So he'd probably end up playing a lot of 80 minutes if he's selected at 10. So let's say in the environment where Nathan Doak, who kicks for his province, comes onto the pitch with 10, 15 minutes to go. What happens there?
So in general, what happens is, like, the 10s, it's that point in the article, the 10s feel like that they, if they're the kicker, they have to be the kicker.
Yeah.
But from a coaching perspective, I think if someone like Nathan Doak comes in, and whoever, if it was Prendergast, if it's Crowley, I think you can take a lot of pressure off him by saying, when he comes in, he's going to kick, and have it pre-arranged, because you'll see it sometimes, guys going to get the ball, kicking for touch, doing different things. But it's like tens have like a god complex. Let's call it speed. Obviously, in France, we see, like, nobody's kicking better than Ramos, so that's they're lucky, and you can see the pressure it lifts off the French tens when they're in their Intermac, whoever's Jalabert, whoever's there. But certainly, I think I agree with that article. I think there needs to be a broader picture, and if someone isn't performing and there's someone else on the pitch, it just needs to be taken away and let them, like, let the likes of Crowley, Prendergast work on, I suppose, that in-game playing, putting players into space, you know, different areas like that. But certainly in Ireland in particular, I've seen it, because I've played a little bit in Australia. you could have eights kicking in Australia, six hookers nearly.
Whoever is
the best kicker.
If Harry Byrne is on there, it's not a question.
Yeah.
He continues to kick. But so that you call it a God complex, right? But like, let's call it a confidence thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, so you are sort of saying to Jack Crowley, with 15 minutes to go, we're passing the ball over. And I suppose from a coach's point of view, you're kind of thinking, well, this is a knock back to his confidence.
It is, unless you have that pre-arranged, you know, so it's a
but
very...
But you're still saying to him overtly, you're not as good a kicker.
No, because I feel like you're basically saying this guy has to get a shot. He's coming on. He's got a boot. You've 60 minutes with the ball. When he comes on now, he's going to take over those duties. If Crowley's kicking and he's bad, and then you're like, oh, we're going to... Then obviously it gets into your head and you're thinking, what's going on around here? But I feel like if it was pre-planned, changing up the kicker, and you know going into it, then you're just focusing on your job when you're on the pitch.
I'd be fascinated to see if they would ever do that.
I don't think they would ever do it, but I think we need to look at it more. I mean, look at Doak in particular. He's kicking for Ulster. Has
been
outstanding.
That might be the thing that would get him the nudge over Casey almost. So I was looking at it. I started to drop a list of players whose stock have been on the rise since this tournament began. And I thought, well, this will be, you know, we'll see where we go with this. So bear with me here a second. Thomas Clarkson, Joe McCarthy, James Ryan, Keane Prendergast, Caelan Doris, Gibson Park, if that's possible, Jack Crowley, McCluskey, Stockdale, Jamie Osborne, Nick Timoney, maybe you might challenge that, Tom O'Toole, Cormac Azuchuka hasn't seen much game time, but I think you'd have to agree his stock is up, Robert Balakoon for sure, Jeremy Lockman, Van der Fleer, Ronan Keller, Kieran Frawley. I suppose what I'm saying here is, like, if this tournament, which it was really after round one, was about growing depth and building a squad here beyond the Six Nations and into the World Cup, like, Andy Farrell is going to sit down with his bosses after this and go, there you go, lads. You know, no matter, I'm not saying no matter what happens next weekend, that wouldn't be right, but, like, let's say regardless of a win or not next weekend, this has been a massive success.
Massive success. And I think one of the biggest winners on Friday night was Tom O'Toole. He was absolutely outstanding. For a team that came in under pressure at scrum time, Wales' scrum is so, so strong and so solid. And he, early doors, he won maybe two penalties. He was really good around the park, but at set piece, his bulk... he was just really, really good. A lot of people, you're talking about Doris, you're talking about Conan, but for me, if he wasn't taken off in 55 minutes or whenever he came off, he would have been up there with player of the game. I thought he was absolutely outstanding. So that was a huge win for an area at Loosehead when we've had so many injuries and everyone's thinking, now he did switch over, he played loose, he switched over from tight, but from, like, you're talking about going to your bosses, you're looking at that, he was able to take that. Now we'll look again next week against that Scottish scrum, but I felt after that Wales, his height, his body position, I thought he was excellent.
We'll be doing well to get parity next weekend in the scrum, would we?
Yeah, I think it's funny as well if you look at it, and I've said this before, and I saw it again on Friday night a couple of times, like, we were under pressure, but the referees, like, use it. And it was similar to Wales, use it. So it'll always depend on the referee as well, what you're looking at. Some referees do not want to be resetting scrums, getting involved. If it collapses and they see any bit of a ball at the back, they're not looking at why it collapsed. They're saying, get the ball away. Yeah. So it's actually... I'm not sure. Do we know who's reffing next weekend?
I'll have a look here now, yeah.
But certainly... the English refs, I think in particular, are like, get that ball out of the scrum and move it. But certainly, I felt like they looked a little bit better. Tyke Furlong, obviously, after that meme, he was really frustrated because he was just like himself and Tom O'Toole, there was cohesion there. So I think it's lifted. That scrum was much, much better this week. Scotland is going to be hard, but... You know, it's funny, you just go into games and the referees can get something in their head, or they can get one up at the start, and the whole process of that kind of scrum can change.
Well, your fellow former front row, Bernard Jackman, says in the closing of his piece in the Sun Independent today, we will beat them, he says, about Scotland, and win a triple crown, but I expect France to bounce back and win the title in Paris. Does that feel like the most logical conclusion to the thing?
Yeah, I from the start I felt like, yes, Scotland are unbelievable and we saw it there, but I, from the start of the Six Nations, I felt like Ireland are going to win the three home games.
Right.
But
last weekend, or because you could make a case, right, for Scotland, they played Italy and were beaten by them in a monsoon.
Yeah.
So let's not read too much into that, because it wasn't really a rugby match. And then since that, they've been, they looked like maybe not world beaters, but, yeah, but in that kind of direction.
They are, and they're scoring good tries. Their attack is, yeah, as I said, Finn Russell, he gets everything ticking. He's just, obviously, you're looking at the wingers, you're looking at Tuipulotu, the finishers, but he in particular, I thought he was quite, he's calm, he's composed, everything he does, he looks good. But for some reason, when Scotland come play Ireland, it's just not the, they don't seem to lift it to that level.
11 times in a row.
Yeah. It's mad. World Cup as well.
Yeah, and when does Scotland get good at rugby? I'm looking at this from a distance.
About
like,
3 weeks ago. Genuinely.
Not so long ago, the impression I got, again, from a distance was that they're more or less going to stop playing rugby in Scotland. There's no point anymore.
Well, there was definitely a similar conversation that's happened in Wales about closing down teams. And we had, again, I'll reference Tom English, we had him on just before the Six Nations started, and he had had a moment with the coach, Gregor Townsend, that had gone kind of viral, where he had said to him a couple of times, are you sure you're the man to lead this team forward? I mean, looking at it now, you know, genius.
There's also this thing I'm noticing, that there's, you know, rugby's, it's got very entertaining over the last couple of games, were just wildly entertaining. And meanwhile, we got a few pieces in the papers today about football, the Premier League going in the opposite direction and becoming like sort of rugby. The term that's used is that, like, you know, you have at corner kicks, you have, you know, the Arsenal there engaging, basically wrestling matches with the defenders, and it's almost like trying to score tries rather than goals. So I wonder, is it basically chain trading places, that rugby has now become football and football is becoming rugby, and it's they'll kind of proceed in that way, until the Premier League eventually just succumbs in some way. They figured out it was at half an hour. Arsenal spent about half an hour not playing football against Brighton, just engaging in like set
grappling,
delays, goalkeepers, and all that. Are we eventually getting to a point where there's actually nothing there at all, and it's just like corner kicks and long throws and stuff? I think Tommy Conlon has a piece about that, and about, I think, Shane McGrath as well. Both of them have a sense that, like Arsenal, they're winning ugly, right? And they say, well, you know, that's allowed, you know, particularly from the Arsenal, who,
their
you know,
friends don't care either.
They don't give a damn, right? But like for years and years, Arsenal were completely the opposite, right? They were playing this lovely football, and always getting beaten, and actually getting beaten quite badly. And now they've gone to the other extreme, where they're almost trying to, you know, phase out the football part of it completely. It's like the triumph of like data and stats and all this stuff, that they've clearly figured out that the more actual football you play, the less successful you are. So if there's a 2.45% better chance of scoring just entirely from set pieces, we'll go with that, and we won't actually allow you the football. Usually footballers would make those decisions.
Yeah.
Rather than some guy with a laptop sitting at the side of the pitch, right? But it's like, as if football has now become too important to be left to footballers. It's just far too unpredictable and egocentric. So we need that battalion of
but if you were coaching a team, right, and it said, okay, you have an extra, what did you say, 2.5 chance?
Yeah.
Like, and it feels like, certainly watching a team like Brentford, the stat must be more than that. Mm. Would you not be saying to them, here, I don't care what you want to do, get that ball and lump it in?
Well, there is actually a whole almost industry now. If it was my job to be a data or a stats guy, obviously that's what I've been telling, because that's my entire existence, is working out stuff like that. That doesn't have to do with football. I mean, in our imagination, we always have the sense that the people who knew most about football had a kind of almost mystical aura about them. The way, like, say, Vincent O'Brien with horses, that he would kind of just look at a horse and immediately be able to see that it would win the Derby trial at Lingfield in 2 years' time, and then he'd lay him out for the Derby, or maybe the Irish Derby, you know, just this kind of crazy sense of, like, these geniuses, right? And I would argue, to some extent, that is still the case, except those guys have been more or less phased out of the game because they, you know, they, like say someone like Jurgen Klopp, who is a genius, right? You sense that people like him just aren't really suited, but that, like he's not there anymore, right? Arne Slot is, right? Who's a completely different figure. Like Klopp has genuinely a messianic figure who was interested in almost mystical aspects of the thing, like using the crowd, using emotions, using intangible things that are not available on spreadsheets and are not available in data.
Isn't right? the future the marriage of both of those things?
Yeah.
And surely Jurgen Klopp must have been, like, he must have been using some of that stuff too.
Oh, he would use it, yeah. But I think he would always favour I think he would give a higher priority to what you might call the emotional aspects of the thing, you know. And without that, I don't think, it can really work without that. It's such an important thing. I think for Arsenal, the emotional thing is just the fact that they so desperately need to win it. That is the kind of emotion they're harnessing. Maybe a bit like Liverpool, if they win it this year, they won't do it next year because they'll become so weary of just trooping up for corner kicks and forcing it over the line that something will set in, some kind of rot will set in. Because it's very hard to, I think, sustain that. If you're actually a very good footballer and you're not being asked to really use that much, right? It must do something to your soul, I think, at the end of the day. But
if I'm one of these clubs and I'm advertising for a data guru to come in and the CV of Declan Lynch lands on my desk, as you said earlier on, if this was my job, I think was your I'm going to do a quick Google search and I'm going to say Declan is not the man for me in this regard. I have another job from over here.
Yeah.
But
look, it's all a bit mysterious, and anyone who says they have an answer, I think that's the problem. See, Moneyball destroy the world, right? Moneyball is, baseball is different to football. Do you know what I mean? Like that, it became this mystical thing. Moneyball, that's the answer to everything, right? And it's not, like, it just isn't.
Are Brentford not, is that not the ultimate retort to that?
But Brentford had kind of decent players as well. I mean, look at Mbeumo, good player. Yeah. In fact, it turned out, remember Leicester a few years ago, everyone was saying, oh, that's just like, in fact, it turned out they had a brilliant team. They just figured out, they just signed really good players, right? Yeah. Now, that maybe the data lads figured that out, but I think that's lucky as well. Do you know what I mean? They had a bit of luck. Jamie Vardy was the kind of
Brentford, my view on Brentford would be that they're performing above the sum of their parts.
Yeah,
which is
the key to all successful football in history, right? That you somehow figure out that mystery. We see it most kind of acutely in international football, where someone like Iceland, who are, God knows at what standard those players are in terms of, like, by relation to the Premier League, but it would probably be League Two or something at them, and they're there, this cohesive. They're getting absolutely the most out of everything they have, which is what coaching is about. Like, you know,
my point on Brentford would be
you wouldn't sign those guys if you were going into the data. Do you know what I mean? You need some sort of vision to put it together.
Well, the success of Brentford is in part to do with the talents of Keith Andrews and in part to do with the talents of the system. Yeah. Like Thomas Frank was seen as a brilliant manager.
Yeah.
He leaves very quickly.
Yeah.
He's derided. I was at the Brentford Tottenham game on New Year's Day. The Tottenham fans are singing boring, boring Tottenham. Do you know what I mean? He's come home to a hero's welcome while his current fan base are deriding him from the stands. I don't know. Listen, I it feels like are you saying there's no room for this stuff in the game?
For the
data?
Oh, there's room for it.
Yeah.
No, there's room for it. What I'm suggesting is that it's tipped over into the other side.
Too much.
And like you'd Ruud Gullit coming up during the big and say you just can't look at football anymore. Now Ruud would have a certain kind of image as a wild and crazy guy, who loves art. But at the same time, there's a lot in what he says, and I think people have connected with that quite a lot. I mean, the very simple point is that, years back, Stoke City were the team that used to do long throw-ins because they didn't.
Yeah.
If Tony Pulis figured out, himself, something friend of Harry Redknapp, a football man to the, you know, to the nth degree, and figured out they don't have the players to be able to kind of turn it on and to beat, like, you know, whatever, Arsenal at their own game. Therefore, they need to use these other techniques, like if a fella who can hurl the ball into the penalty area and cause a bit of chaos, that equalises it a bit. And that's very sensible and very intelligent. You're not knocking it, but when you have players, teams who have all the talent in the world at their disposal, and they're kind of putting that to one side and doing the Tony Pulis thing, that's not right. I mean, so at some point you start to lose the point of football, and you.
I do know there are a lot of purists that hate it, and this doesn't mark me out as a purist, but I love the long throws. I absolutely love the chaos.
I love it as well.
Piece with Keith Andrews, Paul Rowan in the Sunday Times. I like things to be a certain way. Keith Andrews flexing his love for the FA Cup tradition, and there's no club that he would rather manage than Brentford. I mean, certainly the case when he's after signing himself a new, was it 8-year deal or whatever it was during the
seven,
week?
Seven, I think.
Seven. Yeah. For Andrews, the pressure could hardly be lower. This is ahead of the West Ham game in the FA Cup tomorrow night. Even if this cup run ends tomorrow night, he's still on course to be shortlisted for manager of the season, and having signed a contract extension until the summer of 2032, he's clearly ready to start making more of an imprint on the team. It's an incredible paragraph that, like, a few months ago when people were rushing to say he was a busted flush, what are they doing appointing him? He has no experience, and Brentford are going down. In fact, they were the fourth favourites to go down after the three promoted teams, and it really couldn't be any more opposite than that. In the shortlist for manager of the season.
I know, and he was supposedly the first going to be going out the door as well, according to the bookies as well. But look, it's a great story. Just something like that, I suppose, gives you a bit of hope as well, that someone can come in. Everyone talks about having to have experience in that top high performance. You know, when people are talking about United job now, you can see that these sometimes, like you said, that emotive side of things, and guys that know how to get the best out of, obviously there's systems in place and how they play, but he also knows how to get the best out of people. I think that's undervalued, and you can see it every now and again when someone like Keith Andrews comes in, or the United stuff as well.
I mean, you know, you always think, oh, things have, you know, got to an extreme level, you know, in certain areas, but like, I think it is increasingly difficult to nearly impossible now to manage a Premier League team in which people are getting paid like £250,000 a week, right? I mean, there was a thing during the week, it showed all the Liverpool players arriving at the training ground in their cars, right? Like, you know, your car's like £350,000 worth of a car. I mean, if I was like 23 and driving around in a £350,000 car, getting me into work would be an achievement in itself. Like, you admire them enormously that they're actually able to just bestir themselves to do anything, right? And you have this, like, Thomas Frank, we're talking about Brentford, right? Yeah. I would have, thought that Thomas Frank was a great appointment at Tottenham, right? He was really, like, he'd done so well. Yeah. He was, like, really bright, you know. He's someone who I would have thought, like, you know, someone at Liverpool or United would be somewhere that he would go. I really thought he seemed like a really good manager. He goes to Tottenham, and within like 6 months, he's this kind of reviled figure, right? Why? I mean, like, clearly there's a culture. There's a culture in a club, or there's you're trying to get these guys to sort of just do the business must be increasingly hard. I mean, you remember I was speaking of Klopp earlier, but Klopp also had James Milner, who was absolutely a sergeant major type, right? And you could see him even giving out to Virgil van Dijk, right? Virgil, you know, did something stupid once, and, you know, Milner is berating him on the pitch, right? And, you know, it could be that James Milner's role at Liverpool is far more important than was generally acknowledged at the time, because you sort of almost need someone like that who can just stop these lads from just, like, idling. You know, how do you even motivate yourself when you've got all that in your life, right? You're living in a bloody mansion somewhere in your early 20s with, like, being of the players who weren't driving in their magnificent cars, the rest were being chauffeured, right? In other words, the ones driving the cars were sort of like the fellas, like, putting in a bit of hard slog, right? So it must be just so difficult. And, like, the idea of that, if Thomas Frank had a James Milner at Tottenham, who knows, maybe that would have made that. It was at Brentford, yeah. Jordan Henderson.
Yeah,
no, he doesn't play every game, but take your point.
Yeah, and then you have, was it in goal, like Kante? I was just thinking when you were talking about that, and didn't he have like this banged up tiny car? And and everyone at Chelsea's like, he never changed and he used to come in the little car and he just had no care for that kind of stuff.
That's interesting. Oddly enough, the least impressive car was Virgil van Dijk. It was a mere 80 grand or something like that, and it hadn't been washed for a while. Now, whether that's just a PR thing on his part, we don't know, but it was interesting, you know.
I wasn't going to mention this piece until you started getting into cars and the value of them, but Paul Rowan also has a piece in the Sunday Times, Keane rubbed up the wrong way again, and I don't know, it's just bad between him and Masur that used to be at Manchester, I don't know, whatever. But the thing that did sort of jump out to me was here, the Masur for Ronaldo back in the Cristiano Ronaldo back in the day had asked Masur for some girl's number from the X Factor and what's in it for me, some version of the retort, and then eventually gets the number, and Ronaldo, it says here, had a Porsche convertible. He said, when I go to Real Madrid, I'll sell it to you for half price. This was the trade off. It took me about 10 minutes to get her number, pass it on to him. Sure enough, end of season comes and I ask if the deal is still good. Yeah, he's sticking to it. But yeah, 30 grand I give him for a 60 grand car. Next day I sold it for 50 grand. And I haven't seen this clip. I don't know who the hell, who this person is. But I can see him like pumping out his chest and going, oh, brilliant, I just made 20 grand on that. But I've just realised, like, he sold Ronaldo's Porsche convertible for 50 grand. What are you, double the, what are you talking about?
Yeah, the fact that it had been owned
correct.
By Cristiano.
It was a 60 grand Ronaldo car, now it's 120 grand.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a side tangent. Now, whatever, dear listener, you're up to at the minute, just sit down a moment. No distractions now for the next few minutes as we get into this, because this is very important that you pay attention. This is David Walsh on page 16 and 17 of the Sunday Times, and it's certainly one of the best, it's the best piece you're going to read today. It might be one of the best pieces you'll read all year. It is a picture of Harry Redknapp looking very Harry Redknapp on the steps of his back garden, which you can only sort of assume to be the size of the new Tottenham Hotspur pitch, looking out over some expanse of water, whether it's a lake or an ocean.
Pool in Dorset.
Right. The lake at the back. Mm. God knows what it is, some expanse of water. The headline reads, obviously this is sort of by way of Cheltenham upcoming, my nan would take bets from all the old girls in the street. Harry Redknapp has a great shot at winning the Cheltenham Gold Cup this week. The 79-year-old opens up on life, his love of racing and what really happened to him at Tottenham. Now I'm going to read this next little section here and I'll throw it open to the panel after that and you can go where you want with it. But as I said, sit down, get rid of all the distractions from around you and listen up. He is quoted here. My nan would take bets from the old girls in the street, line them up on the mantelpiece, and when Cyril came around selling the Star and Evening News and Standard, Nan would drop the bets off into his bag. Off course betting was then illegal. Nan got nicked on a regular basis. I'd be coming from school and would see her being taken away in a Black Mariah, for anybody who needs to know, is a police truck. Don't worry about these bastards, she'd say. I'll be back in an hour. Your dinner's in the oven. This is like one of the most, like, sorry, my nan got nicked on a regular basis. Yeah, yeah. It's just a throwaway line that's in here. And it's, I suppose, all by way of painting the picture of who Harry Redknapp is, his relationship at racing, and it's fantastic writing and very much worth your time today.
Mm. Yeah, no, Harry opens up a lost world, in which even the more on that quote, he says, they'd give her a slap on the wrist and she would be home in an hour. I was 8 or 9 at the time and my nan would always let me have a bet. 3 threepenny cross doubles and a threepenny treble. You don't see much of that anymore. Right?
Hard enough to say.
In relation to it, see, this links very much to what we were talking about. Like I know that John Giles, for example, has always maintained that about 95% of a football manager's job is just not signing the right players, having a feel for, getting the right people into the club. And he always felt that Harry had that. Harry knew a player when he saw it, right? And knew at that how to do a deal for the player. But the last time Tottenham were kind of good was when Harry was there, really. I mean, obviously, Pochettino was very good as well. But, like, the last time they really played like Spurs, it had that kind of, you know, they were exciting, they had good players, they were, you know, they were just, like, good. Harry was the man. Like, he was a really good football manager, and he probably would have been a great England manager because he just has that ability to, you know, figure out a player. But he describes in this epic piece, naturally he's a great mate of Tony Pulis, right, who appears again in
but they make ads together, so I assume
he was at a time, at one point they were like a Moneyball team in themselves. At one point Pulis was his assistant manager, and they used to be driving around the country signing players, you know, this what a world it conjures up. But he says, we travelled all over the country looking at players, says Redknapp. In the car we played a game. With the Rotman's football yearbook on his lap, Tony would pick a player at random, a Carlisle centre-back, a Grimsby midfielder, and call out his name. I had to explain who he played for, what his position was, and whether he'd be worth looking at. I honestly knew every name in that book. And I believe that's true, you know, that he genuinely would this sort of... you know, total obsession with the minutiae of, like, the football business.
Often at the expense of other things, including when he sets up this interview, it's on his birthday, but when David Walsh has rung him to fix the date, Harry has forgotten that it's going to be his birthday. And then, you know, being a man, you know, coming from the area that he comes from, the background that he comes from, he says, well, I've committed to it, so I'm sticking to it. It's even though it's my birthday.
Yeah, it's great. He also, there's a line that always has to be in here. He plays golf with Pulis as well. So he's a member of three excellent clubs in the region, near Poole and Dorset. And he plays, and of course, Pulis is a bit of a bandit. Naturally, he's a bit of a bandit, right? So he says he's better than his handicap, a proper bandit. Sometimes I take one of the new balls. So they play for a sleeve of balls, three balls, right? And he said, sometimes I take one of the new balls out of the box and replace it with a range ball before handing it over. It's all I can do. So in every part of his life, he's trying to, you know, gain some advantage. He's in this piece particularly because he has a horse, of course, in the Cheltenham Gold Cup. I think it's the jukebox man. An average bet for Harry, he says here, would be a monkey each way double, right? A monkey is 500 quid, right? Now, I'm thinking of all the... And each way double,
so
right?
So that's 1,000.
Two horses. Normally, if most of us are putting 500, thinking of putting 500 quid on anything, we would at least want it to be one bet, right? Because we realise that the chances of this happening are so bloody small. And but no, Harry has to be a double in order to maximise the thing. But a monkey, 500 quid each way double. So... I mean, trying to figure out Harry's betting history over his lifetime would be an extraordinary thing and an extraordinary adventure in itself before he even went near football.
You'd miss Harry Redknapp, wouldn't you? There just needs to be more Harry Redknapp in our lives.
He really is. I mean, off the ball recently, I think it was Owen Sheehan did an interview with him. He does these shows now. He's at 60 shows a year in which he talks about life, right?
Yeah.
And he did this interview with Owen, and it was put out by Off the Ball as a clip on Twitter, I think. And it was just been 2 minutes talking about how his father used to bring him to see the Arsenal. Right? My father, he was Arsenal mad. He goes through this whole world again, this lost world of football and what it used to be like, just the atmosphere at Arsenal, and all the how his father used to. Just bring him there and educate him on all the team, all the players and everything. And he's just a brilliant storyteller and a brilliant speaker. And he does all these shows and they're doing really well. So this is why he's living in Poole and Dorset. I'm sure he, on the downside, there's been probably a few bets that haven't come in.
There might have been one or two.
A few dark days on the all-weather at Wolverhampton, maybe.
What's the monkey two-way double? I can't remember how you described it. How much is that? How much is he handing over in that transaction?
No, he's handing over 500 quid, right? But it's an...
Okay.
Oh, no, sorry, each way. 500 quid each way is is a grand.
Grand, yeah.
And the double obviously then kicks in if the two of them win.
Do you know the way David Beckham would get pictured and, you know, to be this just pristine thing behind him, and there wouldn't be a blade of grass out of place. When you look at the photograph, you can see the ladder hanging out of a door just in the background.
It's quality. Runners are a bit muggy.
And the runners
are
absolute tat. Like, it's very high rhythm. There is an interesting sort of Irish angle on it here as well at a certain point where he talks about his departure from Tottenham that you referenced, Declan, there just a few minutes ago. He says to David Walsh, he doesn't think he's told anybody the story before, and he gets a call from the then chairman, of course, infamous chairman Daniel Levy. Daniel said, "Hello, Harry, it's Daniel." "Hello, Daniel," I said. "Yeah, I'm fine. We've a few injuries." And he had made the point, you know, that he'd never get the call. It was before they'd played Man United. He'd never get a call from Daniel Levy on a Friday. And that Daniel Levy would never interfere with the team. So here's the way the call goes. "Yeah, I'm fine. We've a few injuries. Who are you going to play up front tomorrow?" I said, "Robbie Keane." He said, "Robbie Keane?" I said, "Yeah, Robbie Keane." Then he said, "Why don't you speak with Raphael van der Vaart about who he wants to play with?" I said, "What's it got to do with Raphael van der Vaart, Daniel? I picked the team, not Raphael van der Vaart." He said, "Well, I thought it'd be interesting to see what Rafa thought, you know." "No, not really," I said. "Robbie Keane's playing. I get to Manchester. I'm checking into the hotel. Now, at this point, I've never spoke with Joe Lewis, the owner, not once in my life. My phone rings. 'Hi, Harry, it's Joe Lewis, the secretary. Joe would like to speak with you.' 'Hello, Joe.' Joe comes from the Burnett Road in East London, where I came from. He says, 'I like that forward line of yours, Aaron Lennon, Van der Vaart, Pavlyuchenko. That Robbie Keane is useless.'" This is the owner of the club, remember. I said, "That's your opinion, Joe." He then said, "Why don't you ask Raphael van der Vaart who he wants to play with?" I said, "What's it got to do with Raphael van der Vaart? I picked the team, not van der Vaart." "I'll tell you I'll tell you what Joe then said to me. 'If Robbie Keane plays tomorrow, I won't even watch it on television.'" "That choice is up to you, Joe," I said. "Yeah, it effing is," he said. "Robbie Keane worked his socks off at Tottenham, and I never had a problem with Rafa, who was great for Tottenham, but I think that conversation was the end for me." Now, that did go on a bit, but I do think worth sticking with. Yeah. And I did expect at the end of that story, having painted in such beautiful technicolor and even the details around it, how I never get a call on a Friday, you know, that we played Manchester United and I was gone by the Sunday. But as it turns out,
that was when the rot set in, I think, what he was saying.
It was 4 or 5 weeks later.
Speaking of Pavlyuchenko, my good friend Dion Fanning, remember, has been at a Tottenham game when Harry is manager, and Pavlyuchenko was there. And Harry was trying to motivate Pav, right? Pav was, and he simply said, Run about! Simply, you know, again, not what the stats lads are saying.
No, absolutely.
You know, Mr. Pavlyuchenko, if you could just run about for a while, you might find something happens, you know? Actually, you know, his dad used to bring him to play the Arsenal, I recall there was a little sort of image of the times that there was an old geezer selling newspapers outside Highbury who used to actually play for the Arsenal. And Harry's dad always made a point of buying the paper from him. You know, poor geezer fell on hard times. Maybe the drink got to him, right? So, a man who obviously didn't get to drive to Highbury in his Maybach or whatever, or his Cadillac, and fell on hard times and is now selling papers outside Highbury. So, it's gone from one extreme to the other, but probably the luxury cars are better. Is a better scene.
Yeah,
you know,
it is a wonderful, wonderful piece. It's brilliant writing by David Walsh, and it's not the first time I've said that this year in relation to pieces that he's done. There was a piece around motorsport a few weeks back that he told the story of a tragedy down the south of the country. But that is an absolute barnstorming piece and well worth your time today. We'll continue on the Cheltenham theme because we turn to the opinion pages of the Sunday Independent, and over to page 21 we go, where the headline screams, "The only Cheltenham tip you'll need. The unstoppable spread of big gambling and its ludicrous prediction markets make the days of simply betting on horses seem strangely quaint," writes Declan Lynch.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's right. I did that. Well, obviously Cheltenham, the saps are rising, as always at this time of year. There's that, you know, that hour before the Cheltenham festival opens, you know, it's this golden hour when everything is possible, you know, for Paddy at least, you know. We're all there kind of, you know. This year it's going to happen, right? And, usually people have quite a big bet in the first race, and then the first race it finishes and it doesn't win. And the magic is broken, kind of, you know, but there's still 4 days to you know, anyway. but the point I'm making in the piece is that, like, it's such an attractive thing, and it's such a, like, that's gambling at its purest, you know, maybe the first race at Cheltenham. And that the gambling industry somehow took that and purified it maybe sevenfold with online gambling and all the other things you can gamble on. It's just astonishing that something as already as attractive as that and as dangerous as that, it could be ramped up to the extent that it is. Further to that, there's the, you know, you can now bet, apart from, like, on racing and everything, racing is almost like a sideshow now in terms of what you can bet on. A lot of it is football and all that, but you can bet on things like who'll win the Eurovision or Azerbaijani basketball or whatever. But emerging from the Americas is the terrifying specter of prediction markets, right? Which is a new thing whereby, again, it seems like something that's there already. You can bet on things other than sport, right? Mm-hmm. Such as, like, will Jesus Christ come back to Earth, or how long the State of the Union address?
What odds do you get on that, by the way?
Well, you know, it depends what time of the day it is. Literally, it's so unbelievably open to corruption. Imagine, like, there was one recent about the White House press secretary. Would her press conference last, say, under an hour or over an hour?
Right.
Imagine the openings for corruption in that, given the current incumbents, right? Mm. But the key to it is not that these things exist as they do, but that they call them prediction markets. Mm. You would think that betting on Cheltenham is a prediction market, right? You're predicting something, and there's a market for it, right? However, the reason that they call them that in America, and they're also accessible here, is, I think, simply to evade regulation, right? Because in the same way that social media companies say they're not publishers, even though obviously they are, simply by declaring it so, you avoid all responsibility or any of the sort of legalities that say, the editor or the proprietor of the Clare Champion is subjected to a much more rigorous legal environment than Elon Musk is, right? That is true, and it's mind-boggling that it's true, but people seem to have accepted this in the same way that prediction markets, which will, you know, cause, you know, the sort of predictions about what would happen when online gambling hit America were from people like me, where it would be pretty bad. It'll be, now, like everything with America, we were not alarmist enough, right? It's just gone nuts, right? I mean, because gambling in America always had this weirdness about it, that it was like the social contract in America going way back was that organized crime was given gambling, right? Like all these places like Vegas and everything like that. It was like, you can have this, you know, and we'll have this, right? You know, but as a result, you now see all these stories about match fixing and organized crime figures being involved. So it isn't just like all lives being destroyed over a weekend with gambling. I mean, that's happening in droves, right? But that's almost not even the story, right? The story is that how quickly it has corrupted sport itself, right? So that because there's so much money involved, and it's so, you know, it's not actually that hard to fix a game of anything, you know what I mean? The amount of energy that's going into that is quite extraordinary, and the results. I mean, it's only been legal a wet week, like.
Well, you know, I can see how the predictions bit versus the gambling bit could win over an audience, but as somebody who pays more attention to it, I would assume, than any of the rest of us, surely not for regulators. Are they not? They're not surely won over by this.
Well, as of now, they are. I mean, even of all people, Mick Mulvaney, the former White House chief of staff, who predicted famously after the election of 2020 that Trump, you know, all this alarmist stuff about Trump not accepting the election results. Yeah, he'll complain for a few weeks but he'll go off and he'll accept the results. Anyway, that was Mick Mulvaney's prediction, which didn't quite work out. But even he, I saw quoted, like, he said, this is gambling, right? It's complete nonsense to suggest this isn't gambling. But the whole energy in American culture, and I suppose in the world generally, is one of just predatory activity. You do something and then say, who the hell is going to stop me? Right? In the same way as social media pretends it isn't publishing, they said, who the hell is going to stop us? And the answer is nobody. Mm. Right? You know, governments don't stop them. They're afraid of them. Either they don't understand them or they're just terrified of them. Right? Or in the case of Ireland, like, they more or less own the place because they employ so many people and there's such a presence here. So they just do stuff and then see what happens. And like in America at the moment, if you're running a prediction market company, you've every right to believe that you will just get away with whatever you chance. Like, you know what I mean? That's the culture now, you know? And it's always been that way, but I think any pretenses to having a regulatory environment are just kind of gone. Regulations exist only to be defied, you know, from the top down. So...
I enjoyed your piece.
Thank you very much. You would also like to know that there's the audio book of Tony Ten is now available.
Tony Ten, the book about Tony O'Reilly, who was an on-post manager, stole a lot of money for them to fund a deepening gambling issue.
Yeah, the book was out 8 years ago. And over the years, we've just had a lot of people saying, it'd be fun to have it as an audio book. And for some reason, it wasn't at the time, but we just mentioned it a few times to the publishers, and eventually they've just kind of done it. And the actor Rory Connaughan does the speaking. It's really good. But Tony himself, it does just extraordinary work about in relation to gambling addiction. He goes to schools all over the country. It's almost a job now, but he. What happens is, the reason for that is that his talks are so brilliant, right? And his story is so phenomenal that the kids, he used to transition year students, and they're just mesmerized by it. Mm. So he always gets asked to come back next year to talk to next year's intake, and it's doing enormous good because the real vulnerability, people like me who started betting in betting offices years ago had some at least background in the dangers of betting or whatever. You know, we had some kind of, when it became online, at least we knew what actual, you know, betting was and money, that it involved actually giving money over a counter and stuff. So if you're under a certain age, you have no background in that and no culture of it. So Tony talking to those people of that age, is crucial because they're not going to get it otherwise. They need to see somebody who has had that just mind-altering experience, you know? And
apologies for the Irish turn of phrase here, but do you like a bet?
I do, but I almost never have one anymore. Okay. I've kind of... My loathing for the industry is such that I almost can't engage with it anymore. But throughout my life, I always loved a bet, Cheltenham particularly, you know. I never really developed a problem with it for some reason. I think what happened with me was I used to love racing. My father used to take me to race meetings and I just loved it. You know, I'd be sent following people like Barney Curley and stuff to see, you know, what they were betting. Mm. You know, spying on them, you know, and then reporting back. Yeah. You know, it was wonderful, you know, as a kid. But I think what happened, I just couldn't stand the pain of horses losing anymore. And I think that's crucial. You have to actually feel the pain and not want to get to sort of do it again.
Chase it.
Right? Yeah. And you will lose a lot if you go racing. And I think the key to developing addiction is that you can stand the pain. Do you know what I mean? You just sort of can push through it in some way, and you have this endless supply of hope or something. And luckily enough, I suppose it's like with most things, some people just get a bad experience and it kind of puts them off. Yeah. And with some people, it just doesn't. Yeah. The danger and the problem now with online gambling, and it happened particularly with Tony, who started off, online gambling had hardly been in, like, he didn't even have a smartphone when he started off, but he got into it, so it straddled the two worlds. But like, the fact is that the online gambling, it is deliberately, the systems are deliberately addictive. Right, like everything to do with social media or the internet, you know, they they addict you. The delivery system itself is addictive. So if you have that, right, you have the addiction of sport itself, which is a great thing. You have a lot of it is on television, which is an addictive medium. Mm. They will find you. I mean, there was a time when you needed to be interested in sport to kind of even have a possibility of developing a gambling problem. Yeah. Now, if you're alive anywhere in the world, like they'll find you. So it, here, yeah. That's the difference, crucially. You know?
Your piece here, Tops and Tails, with the anecdote around Monet's Garden and the wise guy who had said, my advice is to back Monet's Garden with all you've got, then go home and sit down for a while and then go out and back him again. Monet's Garden finished second, but it was so close and it was still a great line. And then it's tailed with the 2 hours human to win the Masters divine about Shane Lowry's blow up last weekend. And it closes with, well, it wasn't such a big tournament anyway. The Masters is coming and I might advise you to go and back Lowry for that and then go out and back him again. But you know yourself.
Yeah. Monet's Garden finished second. I mean, like a friend of mine had a great bet on that and he's never got over it. You know, it stays with you. You know what I mean? In the same way as the winners do, you know, like the ones that were beaten the neck.
Right.
Yeah.
They just stay forever.
What
there,
about
you know?
Shane Lowry? Fiona, I don't know if you watched much of it last weekend. Mark Gallagher has a piece on the same topic, but I have to say I was watching it last weekend. I watched a good bit of the tournament. Yeah. Anatomy of a Meltdown is Mark Gallagher's piece in the Mail on Sunday. Lowry implosion was a hard watch, but he bounced back. It was definitely one of those ones, and like the nation loves Shane Lowry, and he hasn't won enough.
Yeah.
I think for our desires as a nation, and he put it very eloquently afterwards about not really wanting to win for himself, but his daughter was there, and he wanted her to come out onto the green, and he wanted to enjoy all that moment, and it was kind of snatched away from him in that he threw it away with some mad stuff over the last couple of holes. But yeah, Shane Lowry.
Yeah, he had a line there actually. I was trying to figure out what actually happened in his head. Even the thing about his daughter, that got into his head. You know, like the whole thing of you have to think of nothing but hitting the ball, right? Maybe it was so easy for him. He was winning it so easily, he kind of got ahead of himself or whatever. But he has a line here where he says, I couldn't feel my club face for the last three holes after 16, right? That's, you know, it was like he just wasn't in the reality anymore. And it was like he was too good. If he had to compete up until the very end of it, like with the Ryder Cup, which is like nearly the last shot. So he couldn't obviously project anything forward. Everything was just focused on the shot. Maybe because in his head he'd already won the thing. He kind of forgot to play golf anymore, you know.
Yeah,
you got a feel for him. Like everybody loves him. Any sports person, anyone I know that met him, he's such a nice guy, and the whole nation just wants him to do well. But that was, you weren't surprised as well that it happened, which is the thing about it. But certainly, I really fell for him watching his face.
Second time in a few weeks.
Yeah,
it's funny.
Even like amateurs, like I mean, down my way, you know, like so you talk to someone like playing the last two holes at Wooden Bridge with the score, and you know they get like, you know, two pars or a par and a birdie or something like that, and you know if they were to knock it into the water, they would be actually ashamed of themselves. Right? they did it twice.
Yeah,
they would be mortified. Right, so it is a major. It's a major thing for him to do, like to do twice. You know, is. It's almost, I think the worrying thing for him would be that it's kind of inexplicable to him. But it's actually probably simpler than that he just literally just got ahead of himself. Yeah. Which you can't
do. I heard him talking about it afterwards. You knew it was on the bingo list of stuff he was going to say. I didn't get ahead of myself.
Okay.
But then he did say that, but then equally he was talking about, I was hoping that I'd get my daughter
there, yeah. She was waiting to see me.
A glaring issue in the shade, Paul Kimmage in the Sunday Independent. Doper playing in AIL is not a good look for the game and raises important questions about testing in rugby. It's a 2.5-page piece. Story of an Australian player. He's been brought into the AIL, an AIL club, Old Wesley, just after serving a doping ban, which the player himself claims was accidental. The piece details a lack of depth of testing of players. It says, records reveal only 2 anti-doping tests were carried out in the AIL last season. That just same documents show that just 34 tests have been conducted across the same competition in the last decade.
Yeah, that was extraordinary. That's an extraordinary part from it.
Some confusion about even who should be doing the testing, it turns out, and raises a question about whether the player himself deserves a second chance. The Old Wesley coach here was quoted as saying that, you know, I work in education, I deal with kids who make mistakes all the time, and whether he made that mistake deliberately or his backstory was the truth, we made the decision to give him a second chance. And then the overall closer of how seriously rugby takes doping, writes Paul Kimmage here, sunlight is the best disinfectant, he asks. Sure, but rugby prefers the shade. What's your experience of that, Fiona? Does rugby prefer the shade? Is there an issue?
Yeah, I think it's not even talked about. Obviously, you hear stories, you know, in the past with players coming over from South Africa and maybe not playing for a little while just because of whatever's gone on. So there is chat about it, but I was shocked to read about the AIL, especially in the way the game's gone, and it's in the last couple of years, those players that you're seeing on the outskirts of Munster, Leinster, like, they're all playing AIL. Look at Ballacoon, he was playing AIL early doors. So it's certainly something that they need to look at and have to have a go, because nobody wants it in the game, obviously. And because rugby's so physical, it's that around it. There's all talk about injuries, different things, players, but certainly you hear chatter about different players, different clubs, different things, but it's not spoken about openly.
Okay. Is there much testing in the women's game?
No, none. Yeah, obviously at international level there is, but even it's nothing at all, I'd say, in obviously AIL, even with Munster, Interpros, there's no testing there. So yeah.
And purely from, like you say, from a safety point of view, it's not unlike boxing.
Yeah, exactly. It's the safety of it, and it doesn't take much to get to do that and sort that out. But you're even, you have a few highlighted there reading the article about, like, we all know in South Africa, but how it's declined the amount of testing after winning the World Cup in 2023. So it doesn't seem, there needs to be a world rugby thing on it. I feel like it needs to be one across the board, but also like they need to focus on the unions of each team as well.
Well, there was massive confusion between Sport Ireland, the IFU, and World Rugby as to who should actually be even doing the testing. But it was at that low a level, obviously nobody was taking responsibility for it.
No, and that's the thing. And there might be, you know, like, obviously there's chatter, there might be nothing there, but you can't do not.
You have
to
have the testing, because, like, one of the points that's made over the course of the piece as well is that, like, when I'm weighing it up in my head, am I going to take this thing or not? Well, if there's almost no testing, then that tips the scale for
Yeah, and even, like, people are talking about even testing, they should be testing in schools, rugby. Do you know what I mean? Like, that by the time those senior
why
cup
not?
Games, yeah, why not? Because it just sets that, and you roll into, whether it's AIL or you get contracted, the awareness is always there. There is a possibility, and you have to watch what you take. But it's interesting with the article, it kind of goes from a coaching kind of side when I'm reading it about, you know, like, it's a 4-year ban. You have to let someone, you know, obviously he's moved over to Ireland and is playing, and he was on the Sevens circuit, and you can read it. He states clearly, you know, he's at that level. He's played Sevens with Australia. He doesn't need to be taking anything, is kind of his point, is what he's saying in the article.
He says that he was using a blender that his
friend,
his flatmate, who was a big gym head, was using, and they must have been taking something that there was residue left in. And
yeah, and then, but then,
oh,
there's,
look, when you're explaining these things, it's never a great look anyway, is it?
No, and then what they tested wasn't the stuff that he was taking either or something, so there was a crossover.
Yeah.
But it's that, just, I mean, from that coaching perspective, it's like, like, it's 4 years he served his ban. He probably should get another chance. But on the other side of it, he's over here playing, and there's absolutely no testing. So that's where you know, that's the thing. Like, how come he's here playing as well?
Yeah, well, there was all that stuff, and it's mentioned in the piece as well, with Gerben Grabler, obviously, from a few years ago, and players' appetite for being in a dressing room with somebody who's been caught. Might be low.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Kimmage, he quotes from last Monday, Ben Rumsby in the Daily Telegraph. It just says, drug tests on rugby players in South Africa have plunged more than sixfold in the past decade. The significant drop in testing has coincided with the Springboks becoming the most dominant force in Test rugby, winning back-to-back World Cups in 2019 and 2023.
Yeah, testing is never a bad thing, I think, is the takeaway here, and it should be a bit more thorough, possibly, than it is at the minute. Want to mention, we don't have a huge amount of time, but do want to mention Nadine Doherty's piece in the Sunday Independent today. Integration must not be kicked down road. Ladies Football and Camogie Associations are bringing plenty to the table. And her overall point here, she says, there's a genuine fear in the GAA community and current expenditure in the association will have to be split three ways when integration is finalised. She says there's no commentary on just how much women will bring to integration and how self-sufficient they are at present, which is kind of the nub of the piece. She quotes an interview she's done with Gemma Begley, who's the GPA's Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Manager, who says, we aren't hearing any of that opportunity or potential and that the impact it'll have on the female game, and that story needs to be told. You'd swear the women's game are being run on fresh air at the minute, and closes it out with the words of Nadine Doherty here. Integration has always been grounded in the belief that it will modernise Gaelic games, promote equality and strengthen each sport. That is the right thing for everyone.
Yeah, and it's mad that, you know, the, what is it, 2027, and it, like pushing it out by a possible 10 years is...
This has been mooted by the incoming GAA president, Derek Kent.
Yeah.
He identifies 2034. The GAA's 150th anniversary as a symbolic target. So he's giving comfort to a lot of GAA traditionalists, because probably a lot of GAA traditionalists don't really want this to happen. We call a spade here. And then obviously, you know, people who are involved in the women's game, ladies football, camogie, are saying this is just too long. It is
too long, because those players probably won't even be playing. You know what I mean? A lot of those players will be gone from the game. Yeah. You know, so you can't even strive when you're talking about that. It's, if you're talking 8 years away, you don't know. It's mad that it's that such a distance, and especially with the target that was set. And even just reading the piece, you know, you highlighted a lot of what she was saying as well, but like, she's like, nobody's talking about the amazing job that teams are doing and how they're self-sufficient and what they bring. And I suppose the other side of it is, when you do put focus on it, and the, like, the integration obviously would be huge for these teams. But when you do put focus, if you look at this, we were talking about stats earlier, if you look at stats of other female sports, I mean, football in England, everything, the game grows. So there's no, and she speaks about, it's always only negativity attached when talking about the integration, but it's actually would be very, very good for the GAA for that to kick on and actually get it done.
What does women's rugby need to do to, where is it at, and what's, you know, what is the any cautionary tales from women's rugby, or where is the game at in general? What does it need?
Yeah, just I suppose just from a cautionary tale is that when you go under that big umbrella of organisations, and the what's talked about and what's been done in the past is men's game, that sometimes the model that they base everything off of is the men's game. And it might not be right. So when you look at, in rugby in particular, the playing numbers would be much lower. So when you look at trying to bring in professionalism or you know, get these guys up to play with Ireland and play with Munster, the club game is forgotten. And you look at the men's game, that can work because they have such huge playing numbers, and there's that edge that you talk about, where, you know, the step down and, oh, you're being called up and you're being called up. Like, it's not that way in the women's game. We don't have enough players. So I think the cautionary tale around is you have to look after the grassroots, because in the men's game there's so many teams, players that it can look after itself. But with that, you want to make high performance, but there's a huge gap between that. So I think that's just something from rugby, I think, that they'd want to look at as well, kind of do research in female sports in other areas. Don't just base everything off what the men are doing, I suppose.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And yeah, I think it's deflating for anybody who wants to see this happen to hear 2034 being bandied about so early. It's some way down the track. Mary McAleese has an awful lot of work to do, obviously, on it. I just want to mention the Conor McKeown piece, Hold the Back Page. It's worth a read today. We don't really have time to get into it, but
it's a brilliant piece.
Don't judge Joxer if he stalls the van. And it's about really everything that's going on, I suppose, that makes the sport and politics, the relationship between Trump, Infantino, the Israeli football mess and so on. And I suppose it asks the question at the end about whether you're going to go to the to Trump Dune Beg to watch the golf. We just want to go and see Rory. We can't plead ignorance anymore, though, says Conor McKeown here. Acknowledge or ignore, care or don't care, but we must choose. It's a consequence of war. They have spoiled the innocent pleasure of watching sport. It's a grim thought, but
Connor's a really brilliant writer, and he has this paragraph here. The World Cup is tainted. The main host nation has murdered the head of state of a participating country. Give that a second to percolate. Such is the state of the world that, you know, you state things.
Yeah.
And, you know, you really should have about an hour to think about it afterwards, but it's just flying past you, the enormity of some of this stuff, you know. And that kind of captures some of that madness, you know. Yeah.
We've covered an awful lot of ground, but thoroughly enjoyable hour and a half or thereabouts. Declan Lynch, Fiona Hayes, thanks a million.
Cheers.
Thank you, Adrian.
That's the Sunday Paper Review for today.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.
With Optimum Nutrition, the official performance nutrition partner of the IRFU.
This is News Talk.